You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
Welcome to the Director Series Podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
After the breakout success of Reservoir Dogs, director Quentin Tarantino had understandably emerged as a filmmaker to watch. He was clearly on an upward trajectory, but rather than a slow, steady climb to the top, he was about to board a rocket ship. The second film by a new director can often make or break a career, and the promise evidenced by his first would be cemented by the success of 1994's Pulp Fiction, a genuine phenomenon that would charge Tarantino with a degree of renown and celebrity that few filmmakers, even the successful ones, ever get to see. Together with his 1999 follow-up, Jackie Brown, Pulp Fiction electrified audiences with its postmodern collage of mid-century graphic novels and 70s-era blaxploitation films. Indeed, both films are united by an intense nostalgia for the 1970s, despite their respective narratives' placement in contemporary times. They also benefit from a shared, effortless cool factor, a tangible manifestation of their young director's artistic swagger that would prove rather influential in mapping out the cinematic trends of the 1990s and beyond. Many filmmakers set out to chase the cultural zeitgeist with their work, but very few see their work become the zeitgeist itself. So it is with Pulp Fiction, not just a definitive 90s film, but the 90s defined, a violent swirl of postmodern pastiche, black humor, and hipster cool that made Hollywood finally realize that independent voices were a force to be reckoned with and profited from. One of the most quotable films ever made, its taste-making influence continues to reverberate through not just film, but the fashion, music, and art worlds as well. Without Pulp Fiction, there is no Quentin Tarantino, the promise of Reservoir Dogs unfulfilled, a dormant universe of now-iconic characters never given breath.
Oh, man. I will never forgive your ass for this shit. This is some fucked up, repugnant shit.
Jules, did you ever hear the philosophy that once a man admits that he is wrong, that he is immediately forgiven for all wrongdoings? Have you ever heard that?
Get the fuck out of my face with that shit. The motherfucker said that shit never had to pick up itty-bitty pieces of skull on account of your dumb ass.
Taking its title from the phrase popularized by pulp magazines and crime novels that proliferated during the mid-20th century, bolstered by their insatiable appetite for show-stopping violence and stylishly cynical dialogue, Pulp Fiction sprung from an idea that Tarantino hatched with Roger Avery, a fellow aspiring screenwriter who would go on to success in his own right, as well as a hefty prison sentence for drunk driving and manslaughter, but that's a story for another time. Sometime in the fall of 1990, Tarantino and Avery were toying with writing a short film, under the auspices that they'd have an easier time securing a producer than if it were a feature. When they quickly realized that Hollywood didn't work that way, they reformulated the idea as a trilogy of shorts. Tarantino would make one, Avery the other, and the third slot was left unclaimed. Both men subsequently expanded their own story into a feature-length script, with Tarantino's section ultimately becoming Reservoir Dogs, and Avery's serving as the basis for Pulp Fiction's Gold Watch subplot with Christopher Walken. This three-part anthology structure was inspired in large part by Mario Bava's classic 1963 horror film, Black Sabbath, to the extent that the earliest iterations of their writing bore the title Black Mask. After the release of Reservoir Dogs in 1992, however, Tarantino suddenly found himself as an in-demand writer. Natural Born Killers, a script that Tarantino had previously and unsuccessfully attempted to direct himself on a budget of $500,000, found new life as a directing vehicle for Oliver Stone. In selling the option for $10,000, an attempt to cut his losses or claw back whatever compensation he could, perhaps, Tarantino inadvertently set himself up to learn a hard lesson about the development process of Hollywood studios. To borrow a phrase that Tarantino himself might use, Stone and his team proceeded to use only the sizzle and dumped all the steak. Stone's decision to shift the focus from a journalistic perspective to that of a love-drunk couple on a violent rampage necessitated major story changes that, amongst many other things, reduced Tarantino's on-screen credit to a mere story by. Though he reportedly wished Stone good luck and warm regards in a 1993 interview, he's subsequently gone on to disown the finished product. This would not be the case with his other produced screenplay from this period, 1993's True Romance, one of the crown jewels of the late director Tony Scott's filmography. his first studio screenplay, Tarantino had initially hoped to direct it himself, but lost interest, even though he had pulled so much from his own life that he regarded the project as autobiographical. Unlike Natural Born Killers, he was pleased with Scott's ultimate approach, despite the changing of Tarantino's original ending and swapping out of the nonlinear structure he had designed in favor of a conventional, straightforward chronology. A success upon its release, True Romance stands as an important moment in Tarantino's burgeoning career. Case in point, when compiling Tarantino's films in a box set commemorating 20 years of filmmaking, Lionsgate saw fit to also include True Romance, as if to say that any comprehensive collection of his work is incomplete without it. Indeed, working from a first act that weaves together elements of his failed first effort, 1987's My Best Friend's Birthday, with ideas and sequences developed in collaboration with Avery that would subsequently find their way into Pulp Fiction, True Romance finds Tarantino at a pivotal threshold between breakout talent and bona fide phenomenon. With True Romance in his rearview, Tarantino was now free to focus his attention on his passion project with Avery, escaping the stuffy meeting rooms of Hollywood production offices for the laid-back European environs of Amsterdam. With Pulp Fiction, Tarantino's purpose was to take what he described as, quote, the oldest stories in the book, the stock characters and situations inherent to the graphic novel medium, and let them do battle against the chaos of real life.
Oh, what the fuck's happening? Oh, man.
Oh man, I shot Marvin in the face.
Why the fuck'd you do that?
Still high from the rapturous reception of Reservoir Dogs and its non-linear storytelling, Tarantino let himself run wild all over Pulp Fiction's sequence of events, trusting that the audience would naturally intuit where they stood in the story's densely knotted timeline. This trust was extended to studio executives in charge of development, but it was not immediately returned. Columbia TriStar head Mike Medavoy characterized Tarantino's script as too low budget for the star-driven image that the filmmaker desired. At least, that was the polite line. In private, Medavoy reportedly thought the script too demented to feasibly produce, leading Avery in particular to believe that he had just submitted, quote, the worst thing ever written. Thankfully, Tarantino had a crucial ally in his Reservoir Dogs producing partner, Lawrence Bender. Even before that film's debut, Tarantino and Bender had negotiated a $1 million deal with Jersey Film, using that cash to set up the office for their own production shingle, A Band Apart. In exchange, Jersey Film got the right to shop their work around town, eventually ending up in the offices of Harvey and Bob Weinstein's Miramax, the now disgraced and imprisoned producer whose infamous meteoric rise to the top of the indie scene and award circuits alike was due in no small part to this film's success, seized on the opportunity to make Pulp Fiction as Miramax's first fully financed picture. In an admittedly cunning bit of pre-production strategy, the casting of Bruce Willis in a pivotal role was used as leverage to sell the film's worldwide distribution rights for $11 million. Combined with the fact that Pulp Fiction was greenlit at a budget of $8.5 million, this development ensured the picture's profitability before a single frame was ever shot. There was just one last piece of unpleasant business, or backroom backstabbery, left to take care of. Tarantino had to persuade Avery to relinquish the co-writing credit they had already agreed upon, so that he could enjoy a splashy written and directed by a title card all to himself. Whether one sees the move as cunning or heartless, there's no denying it had the desired effect. Today, Pulp Fiction is almost universally regarded as Tarantino's work alone. Avery's involvement, no matter how substantial it actually was, is reduced to a mere footnote in the wake of the film's monolithic legacy. A sprawling ensemble piece about the seedy fringes of contemporary California demands a sprawling cast in equal measure, and to this end, Pulp Fiction delivers in spades. The figure of John Travolta looms large amongst Tarantino's eclectic collection of performers, his flagging career given new life by his electric performance as the long-haired, don't-care hitman Vincent Vega, waxing poetic about fast food and pop culture in between hits of both the professional and recreational nature. Samuel L. Jackson, fresh off his iconic turn in Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park, also received high praise in his performance as Vincent's partner Jules Winfield, an intensely spiritual killer who falls into deep episodes of introspection when he isn't busy dealing bullets and Bible verses to his hapless targets. Bruce Willis lends considerable star power to the proceedings as Butch, a gruff boxer who doesn't throw the fight he was supposed to, his sudden crisis of conscience leading him down a twisted path towards the city's criminal underbelly, even as he tries to escape it. The film's supporting cast stands as perhaps the earliest example of Tarantino's recurring use of the same performers, now a firmly entrenched tradition in his subsequent body of work. It's not so much a theatrical repertoire of performers, but rather, they are the constellations that populate Tarantino's cinematic universe. From Reservoir Dogs, Tarantino brings back Tim Roth and Harvey Keitel in small but by no means forgettable roles. Of the new faces, Ving Rhames, Amanda Plummer, Eric Stoltz, Rosanna Arquette, and Christopher Walken, one arguably stands head and shoulders above the rest, electrifying the film, and by extension the poster, with her presence. Uma Thurman quite literally runs away with Pulp Fiction in her star-making turn as Mia Wallace, wife to Rhames' Marcellus Wallace, but beholden to no man. Far more than the femme fatale archetype found in the graphic novels that inspired Tarantino, she is a coked-out force of nature, held in check by an unflappable cool rivaled only by Vincent Vega's. That Tarantino found her presence inspiring is a bit of an understatement. He would later go on record declaring her to be his muse, with the seeds of what would later become his sprawling two-part revenge opus Kill Bill being planted during those heady days on the Pulp Fiction set. Case in point, the Jackrabbit Slim sequence finds Mia briefly describing acting in a failed pilot called Fox Force 5, the team dynamics of which predict the particular makeup of Kill Bill's Viper Squad.
There was a blonde one, Somerset O'Neill. She was a leader. The Japanese fox was a kung fu master. The black girl was a demolition expert. French fox's specialty was sex.
What was your specialty?
Knives.
Behind the camera, Tarantino brings back the close-knit family of collaborators that helped him realize his vision of Reservoir Dogs in such uncompromising fashion. With Pulp Fiction, production designer David Wasko makes a huge contribution to Tarantino's evolving artistic profile, imbuing the essence of a larger-than-life theatricality into every little detail, and in the process creates an elevated facsimile of our own reality. At a base level, it asks the question, what if movies drove culture instead of the other way around? A prime example of this approach rests in the design of the Jackrabbit Slim set, the single largest line item in the budget. Built from scratch in a Culver City warehouse so as to better evoke the kitschy mid-century diner so popular throughout the Los Angeles sprawl, this set piece is essentially one giant temple to Tarantino's worship of cinema and pop culture, with old movie posters adorning the walls and white staff dressed up as famous old Hollywood icons, including Reservoir Dogs' Steve Buscemi in costume as Buddy Holly. Naturally, a director as cinema-obsessed as Tarantino would lavish a lot of attention on cinematography, and Pulp Fiction distinguishes itself with a lavish aesthetic that belies its relatively meager budget. Tarantino retains the services of cinematographer Andre Sekula, as well as Reservoir Dogs' use of 35mm film stock and a 2:35:1 aspect ratio, both of which work in tandem to realize Tarantino's dream of a $25 million epic instead of the scrappy little arthouse picture they were actually making for a fraction of that. A key decision was to shoot using 50 ASA film stock, one of the slowest stocks commercially available. While this meant the need for much more light to expose the image, the trade-off was grained so fine it was practically invisible. The result is a buttery smooth look that Tarantino himself considers to be the closest thing to 1950s Technicolor. He and Sekula would lean further into this aesthetic by cultivating a washed-out color palette with creamy highlights. Pulp Fiction doesn't look like any other major motion picture of its time, precisely because the nature of its own making was not of its time. Where Reservoir Dogs was compact and minimalist like a stage play, here Tarantino makes great use of an expanded toy chest, deploying a dynamic Steadicam-mounted camera that bobs and weaves as it follows its subjects through long tracking shots. His use of the CinemaScope frame continually subverts our expectations of the format by finding new compositional uses for the widescreen real estate. In one of the most famous shots in the film, and now one of the most recognizable compositions throughout his filmography, Tarantino places the camera into the bed of a car trunk, looking up as Vincent and Jules load up for a job. Commonly referred to as the trunk shot by his fans, but what could be better described as perhaps the victim cam, this composition takes on something of a cartoonish aura even as it projects a sense of dread or looming malevolence. An effect perhaps achieved through the combination of a wide field of view and the cramped perspective onto which it's fixed. One of the film's more subtle techniques is the use of rear projection during several driving sequences. While more realistic compositing capabilities were available during the time of production, Tarantino's adoption of an old filmmaking technology from the days before green screen makes for a perfect fit with his vintage aesthetic. Look closer, however, and one might see that the rear projection elements are actually in black and white, while the actors are rendered in full, natural color. The effect is so understated that it's easy to miss it, but it nonetheless adds a distinct flair to the anachronistic aesthetic Tarantino and Sekula would labor so hard to achieve. More so than Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction firmly establishes the particular stylistic and thematic conceits that comprise what we think of as the Tarantino style. There's the razor-sharp wit, the creative use of profanity, the self-indulgent shots of women's feet, the casting of his own self in a minor role, the recurrence of self-invented product brands like Red Apple Cigarettes and Kahuna Burger, which implies a fabricated sandbox reality his characters share. Pulp Fiction's structural quirks and the redeployment of several similar ideas in Reservoir Dogs points to their inclusion as a necessity of the author's voice, and not necessarily a demand made by the subject matter itself. His tendency to construct his films in a non-linear timeline, aided and abetted by his longtime editor in crime, the late Sally Menke, reflects the way his mind works. Those who have watched an interview with him can attest that he's all over the place mentally, popping around from point to point at a dizzying speed, overlapping, pre-lapping, and forward-lapping, all while still, somehow, making sense. His lack of a formal education in filmmaking, and an increasingly loose attachment to the rigors of conventional three-act structure, paved the way for a writing approach that blends cinema and literature. This shows up throughout his filmography via the usage of book-like intertitles or chapter designations, breaking up what otherwise would be a steady stream of images into self-contained blocks of narrative, each with their own distinct structure and approach. The most common structure Tarantino seems to employ is the Mexican standoff, not just a recurring literal image throughout his work. The Mexican standoff as a structural concept teases climactic, some might even say cathartic, release, with long, drawn-out dialogue sequences that sustain the charge of suspense until its bursting point. When violence finally erupts, and it always does, it is quick, shocking, and messy, the magnitude of carnage amplified by Tarantino and Menke's strategically sustained buildup. Of course, it's not necessarily the violence, the sex, or the drugs that make Pulp Fiction such a paragon of postmodern self-conscious cool. It's the rock and roll. A jukebox soundtrack comprised of pre-recorded music hadn't been this revolutionary since Martin Scorsese popularized the practice with his debut film Who's That Knocking on My Door. Instead of hiring a professional music supervisor, Tarantino assembled the film's eclectic playlist from his own personal record collection, oftentimes sourcing the sound asset from the vinyl itself. Hiss, cracks, and all. This creates a warm, vintage sound that perfectly complements Tarantino's idiosyncratic blend of soul and surf rock. Dick Dale's Miserloo, arguably rescued from relative obscurity to become one of the most iconic needle drops of all time, serves as Pulp Fiction's de facto theme song. Its unique hybrid of California pop and Italian spaghetti western, indelibly tied to the film for all time. If Reservoir Dogs made waves upon its release, then Pulp Fiction was a veritable tsunami. That it won the international cinema's most coveted prize, the Palme d'Or at Cannes, was only the first salvo in its aggressive takeover campaign. Given an immediate wide release by Miramax when a film of its stature would otherwise open in a deliberate, limited fashion, Pulp Fiction was a box office hit, to say the least, bolstered by high praise from critics who immediately seemed to understand Tarantino's essence as an artist. David Anson's review for Newsweek said, "The miracle of Pulp Fiction is how, being composed of second debased parts, it succeeds in gleaming like something new." While Entertainment Weekly's Owen Gleiberman would write, "I'm not sure I've ever encountered a filmmaker who combined discipline and control with sheer wild-ass joy." Then there's Rolling Stone's Peter Travers, who says, "There's a special kick that comes from watching something this thrillingly alive." Make no mistake, however, a film as self-assured and aggressively boundary-pushing as Pulp Fiction is going to earn its fair share of negative write-ups. Tarantino's sudden emergence in pop culture also made him a target of grandstanding politicians like Republican Bob Dole, then a candidate for president in 1995, who called out Pulp Fiction for daring to depict heroin use with what he interpreted as a romantic air. Natural-born killers and true romance were also targeted by Dole's wrath, condemned as representative of a business that peddled, quote, "nightmares of depravity." In the end, the haters and the politicians could do little to dissuade American audiences. Instead, they found themselves roused from an unknowing complacency, breaking their chairs from laughing too hard, or even having heart attacks in the theater, as some reports are to be believed. While Pulp Fiction could not fit neatly into either studio or indie classifications, it nonetheless dominated both of their award circuits. Its prestigious debut with the Palme d'Or notwithstanding, big wins for Best Feature, Best Screenplay, and Best Male Lead at the Independent Spirit Awards were promptly followed by several nominations in those same categories by the Academy Awards, in addition to further nods for Travolta and Thurman's performances. However, it no doubt was the Oscar win for Best Screenplay that was the sweetest for Tarantino personally, validating his controversial and brazen disregard for the time-honored script-writing formulas of Sid Field and the like. With Pulp Fiction, Tarantino had suddenly become the hottest filmmaker in the world, and one of the leading cultural tastemakers of the 1990s. And he had done it entirely on his own terms. The cinema would never be the same. The shockwave of Pulp Fiction's influence was felt immediately. For better or worse, Pulp Fiction also installed Miramax as a superpower nation-state of the indie film world, with Weinstein as its abusive and vengeful figurehead, subsequently causing a nearly 20-year-long sea change in Hollywood's belief in the profit potential of indie cinema's economies of scale. By the time that the Library of Congress selected the film for preservation in its National Film Registry in 2013, Pulp Fiction was already ensconced as an unimpeachable touchstone of American cinema. Tarantino, of course, could have foreseen none of this back in 1994, but it was plain for anyone to see that he was just getting started. The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/The Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free.